Thank you for tuning in to Aster Investment Management's podcast series. A reminder to our listeners that a lot of the economic data and commentary is available on our smartphone app in the iOS and Android App Store. Just search Aster Research and download it today. This week, our Chief Investment Officer, John Eckstein, and Senior Managing Director, Mac O'Brien, discuss the current economic outlook in the era of COVID-19. Thank you both for joining us today.
All right, welcome back to another edition of Aster's Economic Week in Review. Today is Thursday, July 30th. As always, we have Aster CIO John Eckstein with us today. John, how you doing?
I'm great, Mac. How's it going?
Awesome. Thank you. Sabila, thank you for the introduction. In my opinion, I think we have some of the more interesting data come out this week in terms of directional, breaking trends, things of that nature than we've had over the past 2 or 3 weeks. Give us the big picture. What's happening?
Okay, so my big picture is we're moving away from the dramatic recovery of the suppression phase and we're pausing now. That's what I see from the last several weeks, that sort of V-shaped recovery that people were talking about is not happening. So things aren't really necessarily getting worse, but we recovered to a certain level, say halfway back, and we're sort of paused there. That's my take right now.
Yeah, I mean, and I say the trend's being broken because I think that with the, and we'll move into this direction, but with jobless claims came in higher than last week, you know, again, you're talking about higher by hundreds of thousands. And when you're dealing with millions, it's more of a rounding error than, not a rounding error, but a rounding number than it is any type of break in trend. But, you know, with the de-opening or the lack of opening in states and the pickup with COVID cases, it seems as if we're starting to see, you know, more support for what you call the pause in the V-shaped recovery. So John, let's jump right into the labor market. Let's talk about jobless claims this week.
Okay, so jobless claims, I'm actually, I think, a little bit more optimistic than some of the sort of TV commentary. What we had been seeing is basically small increase in net jobless claims, or maybe a steady or small increase. And now I think I'm seeing more of a small decline, though it is, you know, I emphasize that it is small.
And that includes the pandemic unemployment assistance.
The pandemic unemployment assistance might have a data problem this week, but the data that we have as of now, we see, let's say, a 275,000 job improvement to a claims of unadjusted basis, total claims of about 2 million. And so that's better than 2.3, 2.4. But, you know, we had steady improvement from the end of April to the beginning of June, and that number has been stagnant since. So that's sort of thing one of the labor market. Thing two of the labor market, there's a survey that the Census Bureau does that's extremely large, 80,000 people, 100,000 people. So it's a very good survey. And one of the things they're asking people, and it's a special sort of pandemic-focused survey, and they've been asking people have they worked in the last week. Between over May, you know, 5 million people added, 5 million people, like more people say they were working than they were at the beginning of May. And now over the course of July, about 6 million people say, 6 million fewer people say they're working. So there's two things to say about this. One is that it's alarming for the payroll number, which is going to be coming out next week, next Friday. But two, like, this is not a seasonally adjusted number. So if you say you're not working, that's the whole question, right? If you're on vacation, you weren't working. So you expect, you know, more people to be taking vacation. So it's not clear exactly those sort of things have been sorted out, but it is worrying. And I think that you have to be a little bit concerned about the payroll numbers coming out next week.
And then on the payroll numbers and the employment picture, let's talk about continuing claims right now, right? So continuing claims, including pandemic unemployment assistance, is roughly 30 some odd million Americans getting government assistance at this point, right?
Yeah.
Which is, I think we've talked in the past, it's roughly 10% of the population. And that assistance is going to change, whether it's going to go away or be reduced. That assistance at the end of this month will change.
So it's actually with last week's reporting period. So, and there's some technical things. So it's actually like this week, I think people are not going to get it. But, you know, it's certainly possible that they're going to do a deal to retroactively whatever settlement they come to.
Right.
And it's also not clear that the Senate, there's definitely 50 votes in the Senate. There's 60 votes in the Senate for extending unemployment insurance, but that's not, doesn't have all 53 Republicans on board is the problem.
Yep.
So the Senate can come to its senses and say, okay, we're going to pass a bipartisan bill that we can get through or not, right? So exactly what the politics is complicated and makes the analysis even more complicated. But you're right, there's a still 30 million-ish people receiving unemployment insurance. That's probably like a 15% or something insured unemployment rate. And that's a lot.
That's
a lot. We're worried about what's going to happen to those supplements. And also, you know, you do hear some people pushing back, like people aren't necessarily going to be looking for work if they're getting paid more to stay at home. So the evidence so far is that that hasn't been true, right? Like people are staying home because of the virus because they don't have jobs, not because they are. I mean, I'm sure some people are, right? But on aggregate, people are staying home because their job doesn't want them to come in or because they got COVID or whatever, not because
I mean, there's anecdotal stories of people saying it's hard to get there, but honestly, by and large, right. I mean, I was reading a Bloomberg article at some point this week, and it was saying that in the non-high cost of living areas, they did a huge survey. It's a really neat article if you haven't seen it. And it was saying that for the folks that live, that are collecting unemployment with the additional $600 a week, that they're getting 200 times their normal income on average, right? So, you know, if you're not in San Francisco or you're New York or Chicago or LA or wherever the cost of living is higher, because most of the unemployment that's hitting the, most of the people that are collecting the unemployment insurance tend to be the lower income earners, that, you know, 297% was the actual stat. And then the folks that are in the high income areas almost had 100%. It was something like 96% of their income being replaced with these unemployment checks, which if you look at consumer sentiment, if you look at retail sales, I mean, like you said earlier, I think I may have been talking to Rob Stein, our CEO, and we're talking about, you know, when this spigot gets turned off, it doesn't really turn off because the money's in the system. The velocity of money's picking up. So people are, the money continues to change hands, right? Someone got that $600 this week. They went out and spent that $600 in four or five places. Those people that sold those goods, now they have that money. They're going to go buy stuff, and so on goes the cycle. But, you know, that is a lot. When you're getting 200%, twice what you normally make, not working, and if that's going to be reduced to, let's just say, your normal income or half of your normal income, when I think
yeah, there's no unemployment insurance that covers your normal income.
Not if the federal subsidy goes away.
Doesn't work that way. The state program is, every state's different. They're extremely complicated. It's like the only thing that distinguishes states is the state bird and the unemployment calculation.
Right. And I think it's between it's like 40% and 60%.
Yeah,
right?
Usually. I mean, a lot of places in the South, it's like more like 30%. But but it's not going to cover your full spending if you're a low income person.
Right.
And like, yeah, I mean, I think that's the reason that we're not, one, in a recession, and two, our streets aren't burning with bread riots, right? Is that we've given people enough money to live in a pandemic. And it's interesting that it hasn't had any effects on bond yields or whatever, right? And I think people are going to take lessons from that.
Yeah. So, John, as we're talking about the consumer, unemployment and COVID and all that kind of stuff, there was an interesting thing I saw you writing about earlier this week, and you know, must have been 11 o'clock, and you'd said that you were poking around the Pulse survey, which I did not know exists, but now I see how you spend your evenings, which is with the United States Census Bureau report. And, you know, your quote was, in the week ending May 5th, 41.9 million Americans reported feeling down, depressed, or hopeless, more than half of the all-time high.
More than half the time, right.
And then in the week ending in July, right? So that was in May. It was 56 million.
Right. And so this is the same survey that I was just talking about, like the survey of 100,000 or so people. And they ask a number of different questions. I guess I'm just sort of shocked at the human cost of this.
Do you have any idea what that number was in the middle of 2019 by chance?
No, because they don't, because this is a survey that they just started up, especially for the pandemic.
So we don't know if we're just like generally a Eeyore down and depressed society, or if it's like, if it was 35 million in the middle of 2019, I'd probably discount that number a little bit. But if it's,
well, I mean, I think that would be a different crisis, right? Like, I don't know. It's like a half. So, and the way the numbers spread out, there's a gradient, right? And so there's about 20 million people on May 5th. So there's about 20 million people who said they feel down, depressed, or hopeless half the time, and 20 million say all the time. And then there's a couple other, there's a question about anxiety and not taking joy in daily life. And those numbers are all the same. And there's like this epidemic. One, there's a baseline epidemic probably of depression in this country, which we should deal with. And then two is like, whatever bad it was, it's gotten 50% worse in the last 11 weeks. And not, that's not since the lockdown, right? That's just in the last 11 weeks. And so like the human cost of this this crisis is severe. And I can't believe more people aren't talking about it.
Yeah. And another thing that you wrote was that the number of people not working because they're sick with COVID or caring for someone who is going through something related to coronavirus went from 1.3 to 3.8 million, right? And like testing is up and et cetera, but I mean, those are just, those are big numbers when you,
You have 4 million people who are directly out of COVID, like before we started seeing these huge, you know, monster King Kong numbers, then like we would have been like all over that.
Yeah.
It's 4 million people. And most of those people are people who actually have COVID. And that's significant. And that's a big change in 11 weeks too.
It is. So we talked about, you know, over the past 2 months, this kind of wait and see. And, you know, I don't know if you necessarily agree with this, but I feel like we're starting to see some of the information and some of the data reflect the actual pain and implications, or I guess consequences of the government shutdown. So, John, let's move on to a big number that has historical implications, GDP.
Yeah, GDP. So I think we're not going to say, we're not even going to say the annualized number because it's misleading. That's good. We're going to follow good practice. So I think the thing to look at is we have a quarterly rate of a loss about 9.5% of total output in the quarter, which is very high. It was very high. Other interesting notes, think about that, is that about a third of the decline in GDP is due to reduced spending on healthcare, which is kind of funny. It wasn't funny, right? But that's like, we've talked about this. We haven't talked about it in the last couple of weeks. We talked about it like 6 weeks ago, people not going to the dentist and whatnot, right? People not getting dermatology appointments.
Sure.
And then another third is due to reduced spending on recreation, food, lodging, that sort of thing. And the other third is mainly investment.
Yeah, I saw the business investment is down 49%. Is there pent-up demand there, do you think? Or is this just everyone pumping the brakes?
Well, is there pent-up demand there? Investment had been kind of like, capital spending had been kind of weak for a while, honestly. And that was one of the things that was supposed to be improved by the tax cut, which we got back in ancient times, by which I mean, what was that? 2018, like it's in, when we could still go outside and eat, when we could still eat in a restaurant, go to a baseball game. Even before this number, like this number is extremely bad. It's not historically bad like some of the GDP numbers we had. Like investment was down 25%. Business net, real gross private domestic investment was down 25% for one of the low quarters in the Great Recession. It was down 10%. Year on year in both the 92 recession and the 01 recession. And now we're down like 18% year on year. It was low before, and it's hard to see what's going to bring it back right now. I mean, you could say that if we have to onshore more medical production or move more of the supply chain onto the US, like sure, that can make a little bit of investment. But obviously so far it's been dominated by the effect of shrinking investment due to uncertainty.
Right.
So that was a big number. It was telling us stuff we already knew. You know, the only other thing I'll say about it is that we did see about a 5.5% decline in the annual rate at state and local spending, right? Which I've been beating the drum about for a while. Like I'm worried that it's going to make any recovery weaker. And so one of the parts of the stimulus package is supposed to be one thing that the House wants is some grants to state and local governments. And I support that.
Kind of a sidebar comment on GDP. I was either reading or listening to something talking about Germany. And I think we were down, United States were down a multiple of what Germany was quarter over quarter in a comparison. Is that just because we have a much bigger service side of the economy than Germany?
So do we have a bigger service side of the economy? And Germany does export a lot. Germany has a bigger export sector, like manufacturing export sector.
Yeah.
But all modern economies have very large service sectors, right? I don't think that there's, I don't know what Germany's service sector is, but I just thought it was less than 70% versus our 80%, right? So I don't think that is it. I think Germany handled the shutdown better. Well, one, like they were shut down for much less time, right? They were shut down for about 6 weeks and like knocked it out, shut down for real with fines if you left your house. Did that for about 6 weeks, knocked it out, and then they're back in business. And two, they had sort of explicit payroll support, which they did in the last recession too, where basically you just pay companies not to fire people for a while. And so that was much more, they just gave more money to people, I think.
Gotcha. Yeah, that was interesting when I heard it.
I missed that. That is interesting.
Yeah, because every other comparison time frame that I guess I read it because there's a lot of stats. But I remember every comparison period, whether it's the 2009 GDP, like United States and Germany were pretty much in line, right? I mean, percent off here or there, but 1958 or whenever it was saying the late 50s, it was saying that we were in line with the GDP change in quarter over quarter. And there was just a huge disparity. And that's going to happen across every nation, depending on their handling of COVID and, you know, where they get their output from and where they get their, GDP numbers from. So now let's move on to the Fed. You know, Powell was talking for a while yesterday. Run us through what you think's happening and your comments on that, John.
Yeah, Powell was, as expected, nothing new. He's extremely, he wants more fiscal spending because all he can do is lend people money. He can't give people any money. I think where they are is no big changes right now in the programs that they're offering. And I think that they, like the rest of us, are in a little bit of wait and see mode about how the virus evolves. If the economy does much worse, then they have a few other arrows in their quiver that they can use. And if not, they're going to stay on hold. But I think we've confirmed again that they're going to stay on hold for a long time, years.
They think like 2023 or something like that, right?
Right, right. So again, I think the key statement of 2020 is we're not even thinking about raising rates. Yeah. And I think that's the thing to keep. He didn't say that again in July, but nothing would have changed to make him change his mind about that. I don't think that given where the markets are, including the bond market, I don't think that there's much appetite for new programs at the Fed. If we run into an extended period of market turbulence, then that might change. But right now, they're on hold, and they're just going to keep doing what they're doing. I think we talked last week or the week before about some of the other tools, and I'll just say briefly, they could do more yield curve targeting at the long end. They could do negative interest rates. They could do more QE. They could expand QE. So there's a number of things they have left to do. But right now, they're happy. Well, they're not happy, but they think they're doing enough.
Yeah, and in one of the reports from this week, their CPI numbers are, inflation, deflation, and there was actually a hint of, you're talking decimal points, but there was a hint of deflation, right, where inflation with all the stimulus package is what's going to be the theme, in my opinion, over the next 5 years. But in this immediate environment, they had sniffs of deflation.
Yeah, overall, it's going to be tough with such a radical change in people's consumption basket. It is going to, you might say it's going to be tough for the inflation indices to catch up with this. And there's also what they call hedonic problems where the quality of goods has changed. So I'm spending the same for a loaf of bread, but now I have to wait outside for 20 minutes before I can get in. In some ways, that loaf of bread became more expensive, became bad because I have to wait longer to get it. I can't get the exact type of bread I want anymore. So, and they do try to adjust for that, but you know, it is complicated and a little bit messy. So I think right now inflation is low. The Fed is going to need inflation for a sustained period above the target before it's going to think about raising rates. And just because we're printing a bunch of bonds doesn't mean that rates are necessarily going to go up. I think that's sort of the modern interpretation. I mean, there are times when it does mean it's going to happen, of course, but you know, you can look at Japan's experience the last 20 or 30 years where they printed, you know, countless bonds, and they're still flirting with deflation all the time because of demographic factors and because of other factors that are hard to exactly tease out. But
while we're on inflation and the Fed and all this fun stuff, I mean, what do you make of this fixed income market, right? I mean, all maturity treasuries outside of the 30-year were challenging, you know, all-time closes this as of this morning when I was watching, like a couple basis points off. In your mind, what is the fixed income market telling us?
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting, right? The market is right because we know the market's right. Because the two different markets telling us two different things. So we know the market's right. So the question is, do you believe the stock market or do you believe the bond market?
They say to follow the bond market, right?
I guess so. That's what I used to think, but.
It's a different day, right?
We'll see. And the other thing to think about is that some of the other markets, like gold is expensive. You usually associate that with fear of inflation, but it's also a real rate play, right? And so gold went up because real rates are going down. And so you're giving up less, right? When you buy gold, you don't earn any interest on it. So that's the opportunity cost. But if you're not earning any interest on your bond, then the opportunity cost for holding gold is much lower.
Right.
So the opportunity cost is very low now. So I think the bond market and the gold market are kind of telling you the same thing, that the economy is going to be weak for an extended period of time. And how that squares with the stock market, I'm not completely sure about. Another interesting thing to think about is the market for the US dollar. And dollar has been going down the last couple of months. I think that is in large part due to people thinking maybe, on the one hand, they're thinking that the U.S. is going to handle coronavirus worse. And I don't know if there's also some sort of cost to like what that's saying about U.S. state capacity and our place in the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've handled this badly, but it's hard to know exactly what's happening with the dollar.
Yeah, very interesting. John, we always touch very briefly upon high frequency stuff or anything that kind of hit your radar that was and interesting that made your eyebrows raise throughout the week. Anything that you want to touch upon before we wrap it up?
Yeah, so I'm going to say that this last week, I am seeing that as a slight improvement in the job market with claims and the household pulse survey just this last week compared to the week before. And the other thing that's looking a little bit, that's still looking like it's on a recovery is hotel occupancy. Which is still upward sloping, though not as steeply upward sloping as it was a few months ago. So it's sort of like that's sort of topping out. And then there's a bunch of things which, again, look like they're on a pause. If you look at various measures of mobility, if you look at the open table seating data, if you look at the number of people going through the TSA checkpoints, those all look static for the last 4 weeks or so.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are still, if you want to look for areas of brightness, there are one or two, but there's also there's a lot of areas where it's showing a pause.
Yep, which is the theme that we've been discussing over the past couple of months. So, you know, every week I think the data starts to solidify more of a picture, right? It was so volatile at the beginning, that thing just whipsawed around. Then it kind of gave some, in my opinion, illusions of false hope, in my opinion, that the economy was going to open faster and a full recovery quicker than in my opinion was going to happen. And now, as you've been saying, we had this pause in the positive trend levels to more of a plateau, you know, over the course of and coming up to a very volatile election cycle and everything else was happening before COVID, right? With trade wars and Europe was in trouble with economic activity, etc. So we'll just kind of have to see how the second half of the year unfolds. And we'll be here to pick up the data, analyze it, and share it with our listeners. So, John, thanks again for your time.
Thanks, Jack.
Have a great weekend.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
To learn more about Aster Investment Management's research and strategies, please visit us on the web at www.asteriam.com or stay up to date by following us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and our app is also available on the App Store and Google Play. Thank you. Aster Investment Management, LLC, is a SEC-registered investment advisor. All information contained herein is for informational purposes only. This is not a solicitation to offer investment advice or services in any state where to do so would be unlawful. Analysis and research are provided for informational purposes only, not for trading or investing purposes. All opinions expressed are as of the date of publication and subject to change. They are not intended as investment recommendations.